Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where educators go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top leaders across the globe. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Danny Sunshine Bauer.
This is episode 141 with Betsy Burris. Hi there. My name is Danny Sunshine Bauer. I'm a former classroom teacher and school administrator turned life and leadership coach. I'm also the host of this podcast where each week I share my conversation with top leaders from across the globe to help you accelerate your leadership development. In today's show with Betsy Burris, we explore a number of interesting topics like the why behind her work supporting teachers, are you doing damage or are you supporting, rethinking behavior, emotions, and interpretations as data, and teachers deserve supervision, but it's not the definition that you think of. Thanks for spending some time with me and listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. But before we jump into the episode, I'd like to take some time to thank our show sponsors. I'd like to share an incredible free resource for the better leaders that listen to this podcast. It's the top 10 fundraising ideas for 2018, and that's available at schoolzonepodcast.com. And just like the title says, you'll get the top 10 school fundraising ideas for 2018 when you download it at schoolzonepodcast.com. Hey there, better leaders. I am excited to connect with a friend that I met in the Seth Godin marketing seminar, Betsy Burris. And over the past 35 years, she's been a teacher, teacher educator, program designer, educational administrator, ed consultant, and psychotherapist. She currently combines her skills as an educator and psychotherapist to offer teachers and administrators support in making sense of the emotional and relational data that floods their classrooms. She's written a book about this work called The Feeling of Teaching, Using Emotion and Relationships to Transform the Classroom. And that will be linked up for you in the show notes, of course. And she's in the process of figuring out how to make this kind of support, the direct experiential support that helps teachers develop their social emotional competence, a norm in the field of education. Betsy, it's such an honor to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor for me.
So let's start at the beginning. I ask everybody this, but tell us the story of what inspired you to pursue a career in education.
It's not all that exciting or romantic. The first job I got out of college, I should say in college, I studied classical Chinese, which really prepared me to go into education. The first job I got out of college was not with the NSA. It was with a startup educational software company in Utah. And that I was hired to be a writer for that company where I would write stories and, you know, all the data that kids would be using as they learned various communication art skills. And I did that for a few years and realized I actually don't want to be interacting with a computer screen. I want to be working with people. So that's when I started getting into actual teaching.
And what about that people component, you know? So you don't want to be interacting with computer screen. You want to work with people, but what's the why behind that?
Well, I didn't know it then, but I know it now. I'm very, very interested in relationships and how people work together to get change to happen. Back then, I just loved teaching. I loved thinking about how to help people write better. I was in a communication arts division, so I taught reading and writing. And I love thinking, and I loved the opportunity or the thought of working with people who wanted to polish those skills. And the job I got, the first teaching job I got was at a community college where I was the coordinator of basic writing. So I had a whole set of students who were terrible writers, you know, basic writers. Many of them were, it was in Southern Utah, so many of them were international students, Native American students. It was a really diverse group of people. And it was fun. It was really fun to connect with them and help them think better and then put that thinking down coherently. I don't know. I just love it. I love thinking. I love learning and I love interacting with people and helping them grow.
And something I heard you say too is that you're interested in how people work together to make change happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you have any tips. You know, the listeners are mostly school leaders. They're interested in change, right, within their schools to do what they think is better for their kids that they serve. So yeah, what thoughts do you have around that? How people work together to make change happen?
Well, this is where the psychodynamics come in. And this is the training that I got in order to become a therapist. And the idea is that when people are in relationship with each other, they are either, they can reinforce old patterns, old relational patterns that don't get them anywhere, don't get them, get anything, any new things happening. You know, this can happen when a teacher sees a student acting out and labels him or her as a troublemaker and sends him out of the room. All right. So nothing happens. That's a relationship that doesn't involve growth. But the work I do with teachers and administrators is to rethink those data. I call them data. I call behaviors data. I call emotions data. I call even interpretations data. You collect the data and you start, you look at it from, through various lenses, psychodynamic lenses. Like, what does this mean? What does this behavior mean about the relationship? What does it mean about what that child expects from the world? What does it mean about what that child feels about him or herself? How can we interpret data more accurately? And if you can do that in relationship, then you fit with someone in a way that actually encourages growth rather than encourages stasis. Like, for me to recognize that that child is not acting out because he's a troublemaker, but because he's afraid he's stupid, and I address that issue with him, I make a plan and figure out how I want to treat him differently so that he's seeing himself differently, then that relationship now becomes a relationship that where growth and development can happen. And it's that simple. So I've moved through many, many years from teaching basic writing to, you know, teaching in a lot of teacher education programs, supervising a lot of student teachers, designing a master's program, directing some teaching programs, to this point where I'm a psychotherapist and I really think about the ways that people fit together to either stop themselves from growing or to support each other in growing. And that's what I love to do. I see it happen all the time when people can align differently.
Such important work. I'm curious how you get the everyday school administrator, everyday teacher to go that deep, right? Mm-hmm. It's so, because you said, you know, the word, the idea is simple. It's simple for me to label the kid a troublemaker, as opposed to digging and finding out, oh, he's scared of making a mistake and what people will think about him, right? He doesn't want to look stupid in front of his peers, in front of you. Maybe you're a hero to him, right? Mm-hmm. Or her. So are there questions you ask, or, you know, are there exercises that people go through to get into that deep type of work?
The only way at this point that people get into that kind of work is if they either contact me to work with them individually, or if they join what I call a teacher support group, which is a group of teachers who gather on a weekly basis with me as facilitator. And we come together and we talk about teaching in these terms. They come in and share what is hard, what was hard this week, what has been bothering them this week, what happened to them this week. And then we choose an issue and we go deep into the issue. And the teachers support each other in being honest about what happened. And I, as the facilitator, do psychoeducation. Sometimes I explain, you know, I drop a frame in. I say, oh, this seems like it might be a boundary issue. And if the teachers don't know what a boundary issue is, and by the time we've worked together for a while, they do know what a boundary issue is. But at the very beginning, I have to explain, what's a boundary? You know, what do I mean here? Like, who's reaching over? Who's reaching into someone else's space? Who's doing more work than the other person is? Who's violating the rightful roles? And so because teachers tell their story and they feel them so deeply, when I throw in a frame, it kind of crystallizes all this information that they otherwise would, as you know, they'd be like, just get out of here. You're a troublemaker. Get out of here. It's right. Easy. That's a simple thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's actually fairly simple to drop a catalyzing frame into the mix and for teachers to say, oh my God, I've never thought of that before. And once they can think of it differently, they start understanding better what that behavior might mean, what their own emotions mean, like if mm-hmm. they're feeling angry or frustrated. Those emotions are meaningful. And then they get to this beautiful place of compassion where they think, oh my God, that kid's feeling bad. And then I can make a plan as a teacher, or the teachers can make a plan to treat that student differently next time. Either go back in and repair, or go back in and do some sort of a planned intervention, or wait for the next time it happens and do something differently the next time it happens. So that's how I support teachers in doing this. But they have to volunteer. They have to be up for it. It's not something I just kind of walk. I give workshops. I mean, I give a lot of workshops where I have teachers step through these processes, but really, they have to want to go deep. They want to have to do the work.
Yeah, it's not easy work, but it's so important, you know. And I love how you said it's simple to drop the frame in too. And it's like, once that frame is there, it's like people are seeing for the first time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've given them a new lens to look at the behavior and interpret, like you said, reinterpret that data that's coming in for the teacher. And now the teacher's able to empathize with that kid instead of labeling them troublemaker and get the heck out of my classroom. You're such a nuisance.
Yes.
Wow, you're going through this stuff. How can I help? You know, yes. You see the brokenness, you see the pain, and you see the opportunity. What a gift as an educator and as a leader to be able to work with that kid. Or, you know, think about it too, if you're a principal, to work with that teacher that's showing some unruly behaviors that, you know, they're trying to stall the initiative, you think, or be a roadblock or whatever. Maybe there's something else going on there, right?
Absolutely. You got it. It's absolutely for certain that there's something else going on. Like, if you've got a resistant teacher, that's just as interesting and informative as a teacher having a resistant student. There are all kinds of good reasons for resistance. You know, fear, anxiety, negative self-beliefs. So you totally get it, Daniel, that at all levels of the system, this kind of work is valuable because we're always giving each other data about what's going on with us. And I, you know, what's kind of unique about my commitment is that I'm actually not concerned about the students. There's a ton of stuff going on for students. There's all this SEL curriculum. There's, you know, there are all kinds of supports and services and resources. But for teachers, there are very few, it seems to me. There are fewer people thinking about how are the teachers doing? Who's holding the teachers? Who's making sure the teachers are doing okay? And in my field, the field of psychotherapy, we recognize, well, I mean, even field of like airlines where, you know, put the oxygen mask on your face before you put it on your child's. That's true for teachers. That if they are burning out, if they're feeling unappreciated, if they're feeling used by their students relentlessly, and there's no one who gets it, they are going to become less thoughtful and deliberate in the classrooms. They'll start doing damage to their students rather than supporting them. So someone needs to get, I believe someone needs to hold teachers and someone needs to hold administrators in holding teachers so that those people, the adults in the school, can take care of the students in the school. And those students are going to get, I mean, there are resources there for students. Not all students are cared for, but teachers really need the support in doing that. You're absolutely right. It takes effort to try to figure out what people are teaching you about themselves. Mm-hmm. But it actually isn't super hard if you've got help in making sense of the data. And I've heard, you know, I have teachers who tell me all the time, I'm just looking for the data. Like, it helps so much just to look for the data. I don't take it personally if there's a behavior out there. I look at it as data and I try to figure out what is it teaching me about what's going on. So teachers can do this all by themselves, but it's really helpful to do it in a peer group because you get validated. You get empathized with. It's just super powerful.
I think it breaks you out of any blind spots that you've developed as well.
Exactly.
And so when you explain that situation, you had that support of a group, especially when you know those people are rooting for you, cheering you on, they want you to be a success, they can give you hard, objective truth. And that will also, like the frames you drop in, help you see situations for the first time with fresh eyes. And, you know, in my work with school leaders, I see it every single week. You know, we're recording and it's evening here. It's probably the afternoon by you. And so now my schedule is kind of wonky. I work with the school leaders. It's 11 at night, 12:15 in the morning, 1:30 to 2:30 in the morning. But the thing is Betsy, like, you see the growth, right, in people. You see the breakthroughs, the aha moments. And I'm completely like jacked, so excited to be up in the middle of the night working with these school leaders because it's so satisfying. And the work that you do with teachers, I'm sure is the same. You know, I'm curious if we could spend a minute and think about, like, you work harder than most people do in this space and wanting to support teachers. And what is it about this topic and this support that really drives you to want to offer it, you know, as help, right?
It's such a great question. I am aware that, I mean, it's really kind of a spiritual answer. All the children in our country who are in schools are potentially, they have the potential to grow up strong and true and functional and happy and productive. That is, in a position to make themselves happy through their own creativity. And I know, I mean, we all know in this day and age where there is a lot of mental illness and a lot of dysfunctional behavior, a lot of trauma. There is so much stuff coming into classrooms, and teachers themselves have backgrounds that can handicap them in their relationships. And there's all these mandates from on high that are actually dehumanizing the educational experience. It's these, and there's all these devices that kids bring into the classroom that also invite this distance, disconnection from people. I don't think there's anything more important than setting up spaces, either family spaces or school spaces, where children get to grow and develop the way they deserve to. And I don't just limit this to students. I believe it's true of adults as well. I think we adults think, I think there's kind of this assumption that once you hit a certain age, you're done. You know, you're perfect, or you're just who you are. And I don't believe that either. I think we all are improvable. We have these plastic brains. We have these amazing organisms called our bodies. We can grow and change for the better with each other and for our children. And I don't see that there's any work that's more important than that. And I see that in my parenting. I'm like obsessively thoughtful, always thinking about how I'm working within my family. I do that in therapy with people who aren't just teachers. And I do it in schools because I think schools are a second kind of a backdrop, a backstop in a way. If families aren't functioning properly, schools should be places where children can grow and develop this way. So it's just a passion. I think I'm on the planet to do this work. That's the answer. It's a weird one, but I think that's the truth.
Well, it's awesome when you feel like you've been put on this planet to do this work. I can't imagine. Well, I can't imagine because I feel like I'm living out that purpose right now too. So
right.
What
right.
A gift. I like this phrase, to grow and develop as we deserve. And I'm wondering if you could paint a picture that makes it a little more specific for the listeners and what that might mean and what that might look like in schools. Because sometimes we're a little too traditional and we're a little too like we've always done it, right? And it's familiar and it's comfortable. But I don't know that it's producing an environment that kids and adults are growing and developing as they deserve. So can you spend some time there some more?
Absolutely. There's this concept that I love called the holding environment or the facilitative environment. It comes from Donald Winnicott, who's a psychoanalyst and pediatrician, a theorist. He's dead now, but it's this great idea. The holding environment is a place. It's the physical space within which children develop. They grow and develop. And that is ideally the family. Like that's the first holding environment. And a healthy holding environment is one that where there are adults who respect boundaries, who respect their own selves and their own limitations and other people's roles and responsibilities. And they respect their children's boundaries and the fact that their children are separate from them and growing organisms. It's a place where there's communication, where there's love, where there's seeing, where the adults are mirroring to their children how awesome they are, but they're also mirroring to their children what they may not continue to do, what the impact of this behavior is, you know, teaching children what it means to live in a shared reality. And a healthy holding environment also sets limits on behaviors that you can't do that. And I have to make sure you're safe. And if you don't want to make sure you're safe, I'm going to. There are consequences. If you know, a healthy holding environment is that kind of place where the adults keep their children safe. And when the children are safe, and the adults are respectful of their connection and their differences, the fact that they're different people, then all this great creativity can happen. It's called potential space. That's another Winnicott term where creativity happens. People are safe. Kids are doing their thing. They're doing their dramatic play. They know that they can touch back on their mom or dad, but go off and do their own thing and explore. It's called a secure attachment. That's a healthy holding environment in a family. And I believe that a school must also be a healthy holding environment. Winnicott doesn't talk so much about the development of the adults, but I think that, as I've told you, I think a school is a place where children have to be held so they can grow and develop. And I don't just mean cognitively or academically. I mean, this whole SEL movement agrees that children have to grow emotionally and relationally. They have to be good at relationships, but I think adults have to also. And one of the questions that I'm constantly struggling with is, are teachers necessarily socially and emotionally competent just because they're adults? No. So to offer this kind of support to teachers where they can become more aware of their power, of their responsibilities as what I call developmental partners to their students, people in the holding environment who make sure that the space is safe for children to grow the way they need to, that's hard work. And teachers need to be supported in doing that. And administrators are developmental partners to the teachers, in my view of the hierarchy of this kind of nested holding environment. And every layer needs support in surviving this job, which is hard. It's hard to be a developmental partner. It's hard to be someone whose commitment, who is devoted to someone else's growth at the same time that, you know, I have needs too. So a parent or a teacher who is used appropriately by their students or children, the kids are acting out, they're teaching them things about what it's like to be that child. I, as a developmental partner, have to pay attention to the data and figure out what this child needs developmentally, what this child needs me to be providing. And sometimes I don't feel like it because it doesn't feel good when someone's acting out on me. I want to smack them. I want to, you know, throw them out the window.
Yeah.
That's normal, but a teacher can't do that, nor can a parent, ideally. And so when teachers feel those feelings, which are normal, and I think every feeling is normal, they need someplace else to go other than the classroom to work through those feelings and make sense of what's going on with them so they can be in the classroom as a solid developmental partner, as someone who's holding that environment, who's creating an environment that is going to keep students safe while they run the risk of learning and growing and changing. So that's what I envision. I see schools as I say, nested, like tiers of holding. And ideally, everyone in the school would be held. And my suspicion is that if the adults in a school feel held, then the children will know that and they will feel safer. No matter how good the teachers and individual teachers might be at holding their classrooms, if the whole school is seen this way and provides this kind of holding, which is, it's not just awe, it's not touchy-feely, it's disciplined expectations and honest communication about what's working, what's not working, what's going on relationally, what you're teaching me about you, what impact you're having on me, how this isn't working for us, how we have to change things to make it work better. All of that is what happens in a holding environment.
Thank you for explaining that. And I think the listeners probably have a lot of great ideas for kids. There's many programs you can invest in and different things to get your teachers trained so that you support the kids. But I have a belief, just like you said, you know, if you have a holding environment for the adults too, and if you take care of the adults, they're going to take care of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And some school leaders don't get that. They get so focused on the kids, which we all need to, I'm not saying don't focus on the kids. We all need to focus on the kids. But when it's the constant message for the kids, for the kids, for the kids, and the adults feel ignored or invisible or work to death for the kids, then they're not doing that work, right?
Exactly.
So I'm curious, you know, what could the listeners do that are leading schools to hold the environment and make it a supportive situation for the adults?
Well, my answer is that the teachers and the administrators deserve supervision. And by that, I mean, the definition comes from the field of psychotherapy, not from the field of education. In the field of education, supervision means evaluation, generally speaking. When I was a supervisor, I was evaluating student teachers. In the field of therapy, supervision is a chance, like a weekly chance, to sit down with a trained supervisor. And in this case, it's a therapist, to talk about my clients. Like, I see a number of clients every week. Some are going fine. Some are crazy. Some I don't get. So I meet with my supervisor and I say, okay, there are like three real hot spots for me this week. I had a client who fell silent and I was really nervous. There was a client I felt really angry at. You get it. And so the supervisor and I do, as you put it, we illuminate my blind spots because I'm in relationship with my clients. I'm doing the best I can, but I'm, you know, responding to the client's acting out or I'm acting out on the client. There's so much going on between us that no one can control, that I need help seeing that and recognizing where I need to shift so that I can align better with the client and get the healing done. So that supervision is completely confidential. It's non-evaluative and it's psychodynamically oriented. It's all about the dynamics. It's about what's going on, what are the emotions teaching us about the relationship, and what are the behaviors teaching us about the relationship? What are your emotions, meaning me, the therapist, what are they telling us about your client and your client's expectations? What are you reenacting with this client? That kind of supervision is the kind of supervision that teachers need and administrators need, in my view, if they're going to be supported in doing this kind of work with their students. And that is what isn't really normal in the field of education. It's what I would like very much to make a norm, because I think it would make a huge difference. And that is the work that I do with teachers and with administrators on a very, very small scale at this point.
This podcast is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators and podcasts by educators. Listen to all the great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. That's edupodcastnetwork.com. Betsy, tell me the story of writing The Feeling of Teaching.
Well, I have a PhD in education. I wrote a dissertation way back when on called Spontaneity in the Classroom. I was really, really interested in how teachers know what to do when they're flying by the seat of their pants. And what came out, a lot of interesting stuff came out of that study, but one of them, of course, was that they, emotions play a huge role. And at that time when I did my dissertation, I didn't know that I was really interested in learning about psychoanalytic theory. So it took me a long time to figure out that that's what I wanted to do. And so I taught in various schools, ended up teaching in the Center for Creative Teaching at Bennington College, and had, you know, the same kinds of experiences I've had in various programs of being either like weirdly attacked by the students, like, or, and sometimes faculty, because I also directed a program at Bennington, being treated really badly in surprising ways, or finding myself trying to therapize with my student teachers, like, hey, so you're feeling insecure about doing this, and let's talk about that. And I realized either I was completely thrown off by the treatment that I was getting from people I was trying to help, or I was really out of my league trying to help people with things that I didn't really know how to formulate. I didn't mm-hmm. know how to understand. So when I left Bennington, I decided that I wanted to become a therapist of teachers, and just because that's what I was doing anyway. And of course, as I didn't know this, but I was really interested in relationships. And so I went back to school and I got an MSW. And the process of getting that MSW at a program that was really psychodynamically oriented, they were very much about training therapists, not so much, you know, social workers. I realized that what I wanted to be was not so much a therapist of teachers, I am a therapist of teachers, but a supervisor of teachers, someone who offers this kind of clarifying, as you put it, blind spot illuminating support so they can see what's happening in a classroom clearly and can feel compassion for themselves and for their students. And so the book, I wrote the book to kind of figure out for myself what it is that I was thinking about. And I wrote the book one way and then completely rewrote it. So it's basically two books. This is probably, everyone has this story, but yeah. But because I was figuring out what I know and how I do things and how this all makes sense to me, it took me a while to get it right. And at this point, I feel as though the book does pretty much capture the way I think about the world. And I find it has, the process of writing it was super useful for me because I still do what I wrote about in the book, and I published it like 5 years ago. I still do it. It still works. And I know what I'm doing because in part I wrote it. So it was mostly for me, I think, that I wrote that book.
It's interesting because, you know, a lot of times, especially when I'm a guest on other podcasts and they ask about Better Leaders, Better Schools, I started it for me. You know, it sounds selfish, but at the time I was moving into increased roles of school leadership, I didn't feel, I'm a hungry guy. You know, I want to learn. I'm a learner. You know, I love to learn. I want to be excellent at my craft, and just didn't get a lot of support in terms of, like, you know, what is leadership and how do you develop it, right? You get the keys to the building, you get the code to the alarm, and then they just expect you not to screw it up. But, you know, you get the degree too. So I figured, hey, I'll start talking to people much smarter than me with more experience, and hopefully we'll learn from their mistakes. And that was the point of this podcast. So I can absolutely relate to your story in terms of right at the feeling of teaching.
It's so great. And, you know, I want to question that word selfish, because I actually don't use the word. I think it's better to be doing it for you because you have a passion and you have a need than it is to be doing it for someone else. It's like, I would rather be doing this for me than for someone else's, you know, I know it's good for you, so you should do it. It's kind of for me, it's a tension because I do know it works, but I'm not super great at stepping out and insisting that people do this work because they have to come to it themselves. So there is something valuable about doing what feels right to me, hoping that other people resonate with that and want to join, which is what you've accomplished with your podcast and with your mastermind groups.
Yeah, thank you. So we're sort of entering the end of the podcast. Just have two fun questions and then two, I guess, more inspiring and serious questions. But Betsy, I'm curious, what do you do for fun?
You know, one thing I do is I take field trips with my kids.
Okay.
It's not often that much because my kids are old. You know, they're like teenagers, so they're really resistant to this, except my daughter. We go like to museums, or I live in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, and there are just a ton of museums around here, including like the Mount where Edith Wharton lived, and, you know, Arrowhead where Nathaniel Hawthorne was, and, you know, Susan B. Anthony House. There are all these little museums and sculpture parks. And I love going on these adventures, kind of just exposing myself to beauty and learning about other people's lives. I don't know. I just find it really, really fun. And I think it's important to go kind of prancing around my home and get to know its history and what happened here and why it's special. And I also, you know, I really love collaging, but I'm really bad at it. So I love collage. So I would never think to call myself a scrapbooker, but I am a scrapbooker in that I have a scrapbook where I contain all my kids' cool stuff, like, you know, their awards or trip, you know, pictures from trips that we've taken. And so I try to make these pages with these artifacts that I collect. They look like crap and they're just not fancy. You know, there are people on the planet who could just be, every piece would be artistic, but I love it. I find it really meditative and it's loving, and I want my kids to look at it someday and remember. So those are two things that I do for fun. I don't do them that often. I don't think I have much fun because there's so much work to do all the time, but those are two things I like to do.
School leadership is hard work. Why should funding student-centered programs be difficult too? If you're stressed about your budget and where you'll find some extra cash to run a great program for kids, I have a solution for you. Introducing the Top 10 School Fundraising Ideas for 2018. In this guide, you will find the best school fundraising ideas available in 2018. My favorite company described in the guide is School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending brings hassle-free fundraising to schools through custom sticker vending machines installed in your school. The best part, you do absolutely no work. The School Spirit Vending team installs, maintains, and shares the revenue collected with the school. You can learn more about School Spirit Vending and the other magnificent companies mentioned in the Top 10 School Fundraising Ideas for 2018 at schoolzonepodcast.com. Go there now, download the Top 10 School Fundraising Ideas for 2018 at schoolzonepodcast.com.
If you could be automatically good at something, Betsy, what would that be?
Oh man, I'll tell you what it is. I would be automatically good at soccer.
Why soccer?
Because I think it's such an amazing sport. There's something about soccer that like makes my body hum. I think I hate to run. Like, this is more information than you want, but I realize even as an older woman, I'm 56, I love to sprint. I love to sprint. Do I sprint? No, I do not, because I've got this old creaky body, but I love that feeling of power. And so I think my body just loves that feeling. And kicking a ball around, like that sounds, I just love games that involve balls. I love throwing balls. I love kicking them. So soccer, and both of my kids play soccer and they're really good at it. And I just love watching them. And when I watch them, I can feel it in my body. I want to be fleet. I want that burst of power. So that's what I would do. I would be able to sprint. I would be able to play an entire soccer game without dying after one 10-yard run.
I'm looking forward, now that I'm in Europe, to go to a few games and matches. And, you know, it's not something that I experienced a lot in the States. I was a basketball player, volleyball. I swam.
I love volleyball. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to some matches for sure. Betsy, if you could put a message on a school marquee, on all school marquees across the globe for one day, what would it read?
I recently wrote a blog post that I titled Only Connect, which is a phrase from the guy who wrote Howard's End. I think it's E.M. Forster. I love the idea of connecting and doing the hard work of staying connected. And so I think even though it's not an obvious term, like people won't look at only connect and think, oh yeah, I know what that means. But it would also, like, if they went and read some E.M. Forster, that'd be great. But I think only connect, that's what I would put, because that's what matters. I think connecting and relating and caring and staying with people, even when they frustrate you or anger you.
Well, Betsy, you made it. I'm really proud of you. This is the last question of the podcast. It's a big one, though. You're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by your budget or resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you build your dream school? What would be your top three priorities?
Well, I would build a school that was absolutely beautiful. I would build a school with gardens, vegetable gardens. I would want students to be cooking for them, each other. I would want it to be a place that students entered and teachers entered and administrators entered and felt fantastic about themselves because they deserve to be surrounded by beauty. And the top priorities, it would be what I described. The top priority would be supporting administrators, supporting teachers, and then seeing students accurately, setting up a system that's a true holding environment where everyone feels safe to grow. And everyone knows that people are there to help them with that kind of imperfect process. Understanding that learning is growing and it's not just about being able to remember like when something happened, but being able to put ideas together into unique and novel thoughts and being able to play with ideas and being able to argue with each other and give each other space to have different perspectives and finding common ground, at least common respect, mutual respect. So that's the kind of school I would want. I'd want it to be busy and I'd want it to be full of caring behavior. And I'd want every level of adult to have supervision so they could fall apart somewhere and not fall apart on their students, but fall apart on with someone who is going to hold them and care about them and normalize their experience.
Betsy, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any parting words of advice and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
The best way to get a hold of me is to email me at teachingthroughemotions@gmail.com. And that's Teaching Through Emotions is the name of my website where I have a blog and I have stuff about workshops and where my book is for sale. And it's teachingthroughemotions@gmail.com. And through is T-H-R-O-U-G-H. There are no abbreviations here. And the website is www.teachingthroughemotions.com. So those are great places. I would love to hear from anybody, any feedback on this idea. It's such a fledgling idea, but it's a potentially revolutionary idea. I think it could really change people's lives. And I would love to hear back from teachers or administrators who say yes, who say you're crazy. I'd love to get some perspective on how viable this kind of work is out there. Yeah, and that's the best way to get in touch with me.
We'll have that linked up for the listeners. So your book, your website, your email will all be there for them. Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember, life's 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Betsy. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Betsy in the search bar. And the show notes page will pop up. You get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Betsy, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Daniel, thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Better Leaders, just a few more things before you take off. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show. This helps gives the show some social proof, aka iTunes juice, and encourages new people to listen to the show. If you are a social media junkie, share your biggest takeaway from the show, and feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer. Take the letters, switch them around, and create something interesting and new. That's how I got it. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Do you want to get a short email from me every Sunday where I share the best resources I have come across, links to interesting articles, books, blogs, and podcasts that have challenged my thinking, and a quote that's inspired me and will inspire you as well? If you'd like access to this resource, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and join the newsletter at the top of the page. Over 1,000 school leaders subscribe, and I think you'll benefit from it too. In the newsletter, I also share when a new blog or podcast comes out, as well as different opportunities to work with me. Thanks again for listening to the show.